From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is a special year-end edition of The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we'll look at some of the biggest stories of the year and also bring you some of our favorite conversations with Tessa Thompson, Riz Ahmed, Lena Waithe, Hannah Gadsby, Ed Ruscha, and more. All that coming up on The Frame's 2018 year-end special.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame's year-end special. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Over the next hour, we're going to bring you some of our favorite interviews from the year, covering television, movies, music, and the arts. There were many big stories in Hollywood this year, but none bigger than Time's Up. The headlines included prominent executives and personalities accused of sexual assault and harassment, but also all of the people, primarily female executives, producers, directors, and actresses, who were fighting for equality in film and television. At the same time, women were responsible for some of the most significant television projects of the year. Lena Waithe's breakout year came in 2017. She became the first black woman ever to win an Emmy for writing in a comedy series. But this year, Waithe was up to some even bigger things. She created a Showtime series called The Chi about her hometown of Chicago, and she also made her major studio film debut in the movie Ready Player One, directed by Steven Spielberg. She also became an outspoken advocate for the Time's Up initiative. At the Sundance Film Festival in January, she spoke at the Respect Rally, which coincided with women's marches across the country.
People talk to me about what it means to be a woman of color who also happens to be queer. Look, they give me a lot of credit for it. But trust me when I tell you, being born gay and black and female is not a revolutionary act, okay? But being unapologetically black, being extremely out, and being a proud feminist, that's something you can give me credit for.
When Lena Waithe stopped by The Frame Studios after Sundance, I asked her why she wanted to be a part of that event.
I feel like a voice like mine should be a part of those gatherings, because sometimes those voices are voices of Caucasian people, pretty people, important people. But the truth is, those that are marginalized, those that are othered, often need to pipe up because we have a different perspective. And I still find it quite sad that there are so few of us that are out, because the numbers just don't add up. If you look at all of Black Hollywood and say, oh, just Lena, Wanda Sykes, Samira Wiley, and RuPaul are the gay ones, it's like, that doesn't make sense.
That can't be true.
It's not. And so, look, I respect everybody and they can live their lives where they live their lives, but I think it's really important for us to show ourselves, because there are so many queer kids that look to us and are looking for themselves and are looking for, you know, a light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that it's our responsibility to do that.
I'm going to come back to that idea of looking for themselves, because I think that was part of the inspiration behind the series that you were talking about up in Park City. And that's The Chi, which is a series set in Chicago. What was going on in the way that Chicago was being seen and talked about when you started working on this project a couple of years ago?
Well, look, it was seen as a war zone. And look, Chicago, we've always had our stuff. But it was becoming a hot topic, and I was seeing a lot of news stories. I was reading a lot of think pieces about what was happening in the city. And I was just reading a lot of James Baldwin at the time. I was reading a lot of Langston Hughes. And I was just really inspired by the way they wrote about us. So I just was like, I want to really write about black men. I want to write about the city, and I want to show that there's life there. And there are just people that live there and are trying to make an honest living and trying to survive.
Let's talk about the show itself. The story centers around a fatal shooting and the after effects of it, some of which include even more violence. Let's listen to a clip.
The police ain't gonna do shit.
And neither are you, because you're gonna promise me. Promise me!
Okay, I promise. I'm just sitting here looking at pictures because I miss them.
You are dealing with something that a lot of people have mythologized or misunderstood, and that is the role of violence in Chicago and the role of violence among African Americans in Chicago. So when you set a story that is central to African Americans and violence in terms of the story, what are the myths you're trying to dispel, and how do you have to be sure that you're not kind of encouraging the wrong perceptions a lot of people have.
What I never want to do, because I'm not a fan of this whole idea of, well, let's write the reality we want. Let's show Black people in a positive light. I think that's a form of propaganda. In my opinion, it's my job to tell the truth. It's my job to hold a mirror up to us as a society. And that means the mirror is not wiped down with Vaseline. You know, it's like, I want us to see ourselves in HD because that's the only way we'll really be able to do some sort of reflection or look within ourselves. You know, so it's like, look, for those that may say, oh, well, it's a story about violence and this and that. It's like, no, that's the thing where I'm not shying away from that. But what I am looking at is what happens post a shooting, which I feel like no one ever does. And it's interesting because a lot of people say, oh, it reminds me of The Wire. I say, well, that's a simple comparison because there's a bunch of Black people on TV. But to me, it's like The Corner was more of a reference point. House of Cards, Downton Abbey, The Practice, things like that where you have characters that are really flawed, but you can't help but reach out to them and think about how much alike you are with those characters.
That was Lena Waithe, creator of the Showtime series The Chi. The series has been renewed for a second season. Tanya Saracho first got her start in TV as a writer on the Lifetime series Devious Maids. Just one day into the position, she says the excitement of her new job was diminished when one of her fellow writers told her she'd been brought on as the, quote, diversity hire. The tables have now turned for Saracho, who serves as the creator, showrunner, and executive producer of the Starz series Vida. The show centers on two Mexican-American sisters who come back home to the east side of Los Angeles after the death of their mother. Vida focuses on topics like socioeconomic inequality, the immigrant experience, and gender identity in a way we don't often see on television. Back in May, I spoke with Saracho about her vision for her show, Vida, including her decision not to use subtitles to accompany Spanish dialogue. And just a heads up, there's some frank talk about the show's depictions of sexuality.
That was like the second meeting when I was like, y'all, never subtitles.
And why not?
Because we have to be steeped in the world of the mainstream all the time. And sometimes we don't speak all the languages. I think it's okay to be steeped in this world. They'll never miss story, ever. And that's a part in my plays. I do the same thing. There's more Spanish in my plays. And people have to sit through them. And they don't miss. They don't miss a story. And here, it's more Spanglish than anything. But yeah, it's like whole sentences and some characters only, you know. Well, they like Spanish more, but I think the Spanglish world is really important, especially because the sisters don't really speak Spanish. They're second generation Americans. I can't forget, this is an American show. So when Lynn...
In fact, there's a joke, I think, in the first episode about one of the sisters speaking Spanish. She's like, you know how to speak Spanish?
She's like, God, you learned. And she was like, yeah, I was not going to be a pocha like mom and you. A pocha is someone who speaks Spanglish, you know, and is looked down upon. Well, now we're taking the term back, but it's like that term I've never heard on TV before.
The other thing that seems really important to you is not just that you're going to show physical intimacy and sex in a very candid way, but the kinds of relationships and the kinds of sex we're going to see is very different. That you're going to see queer sex, you're going to see non-binary sex. Mm-hmm. What were the important conversations that you had with your actors and your writers about what you wanted to say through sex and how you're going to say it?
Well, those conversations started with the writers, right? And there's one cis male in my writer's room and the rest are female and most of them queer females. So there's one sex scene with a non-binary person. That was workshopped to death. Like we talked about every frame that was going to happen. It was written like that because we wanted to get it right, you know? There's not one way, but like we were like, how do we make sure that, okay, Emma is a top femme, but you know, you don't know until then that she's a top, but by the way she's having sex, you're like, oh, she's a top. And also the way she was woman handling like the non-binary person. I mean, I think they both enjoyed themselves. So it's
woman
good.
Handling, that's what they call it. It looked like she's like beating her up, but yeah. Okay, it was rough.
It was rough, and she was like, that's how she's a top. And no kissing, no, you know, and that spoke so much to Emma's character. Also, that I think that person kind of had a little crush on Emma, and Emma was never going to see them again. It said so much about the character.
So a non-binary Latinx could watch this show and see someone on screen, yes, that they can connect with.
Yes.
What about a gringo? What about, and I'm asking you to use this totally seriously, a straight, like myself, a straight white male gringo, how do you hope their view of the world has changed by watching Vida?
Well, I have been watching male programming all my life, right? And I'm completely interested in it. Like, I love Breaking Bad. I like the Game of Thrones. All of these seasons now are more female, right? Because the queen is a game of queens. So I hope that the interest in the family stuff, the how do we keep our legacy? How do I reconnect with my family member, with my sister? That I hope those things. And also, if you want to take a peek into this world, that if you don't know about the east side of LA, but also Latinx culture, also young queer culture too, like also active, there's an activist in this, and if you don't know about that subject matter, all those things, I hope that are interesting in a way that I don't have to think when I watch an all-male show.
That was Tanya Saracho, the creator of the Starz series Vita. The series has been renewed for a second season. For American audiences, the Australian comedian Hannah Gadsby seemingly came out of nowhere this year. She arrived with an often hilarious and equally sobering Netflix special titled Nanette, in which she actually said that she needed to quit comedy. Gadsby, who's lesbian, grew up on the island of Tasmania, where she says that most residents believe that gay people are, quote, subhuman. She internalized that homophobia, suffered a violent attack, and then, once she began doing comedy, made it all part of her routine.
My whole story was always told around a joke, diffusing it, but also laughing at homophobia, not acknowledging that it existed within me. And so throughout my comedy career, I, you know, went from telling this story and sealing off, you know, this trauma into acceptable jokes. And I, you know, began to really, really wobble in the last few years during the gay marriage debate, because I was aware that there was still, you know, this deep wound of shame that has never been talked about. You know, I often say that perhaps there should be a black stripe on the gay pride flag to acknowledge publicly that trauma that so many of us live through. You don't just come out and instantly undo shame. You need the entire community that helped place that inside of you to also help undo that.
Part of my problem is comedy has suspended me in a perpetual state of adolescence. The way I've been telling that story is through jokes. And stories, unlike jokes, need three parts: a beginning, a middle, and an end. Jokes, only two parts, a beginning and a middle.
How did you start thinking about what you were performing and this kind of greater concept of what is the contract between the audience and the performer? Because there is a very deep and incredibly intellectual conversation that you have with yourself in front of the audience about this whole idea.
There's a lot of complex ideas sort of met at a head at the point of writing the show, and I was in a very angry space because I was frustrated, not just because of the gay marriage debate, but then Donald Trump was elected, and unfortunately he's not just your president. I was just struck by the very destructive way that our leaders tend to speak, and that we're electing businessmen as if humanity is some kind of business and profit is how you measure the worth of a human. And I was a bit frustrated where my career was. I felt like I'd plateaued, that I felt like, you know, I saw the rise of very perfectly fine young men, my peers, just getting all the opportunities. And I'm like, I don't mean to sound arrogant in my own head, but I think I'm better than these fellas. So really that show was written around like throwing the gauntlet down. I make the claim I'm going to quit. And the reason I did that was to subvert, you know, every time a woman does something like that on stage, we're told we're not comedians, we do monologues or one-woman shows. And no man has ever, you know, no man has shown his vulnerability on stage, and, you know, no comedian, and been reduced to, oh, he's just doing a bit of theatre now. As like, so this show, I'm just like, no, I'm going to write the best comedy show, deconstruct the joke, and throw it back in your face and go and live in a cave.
That was comedian Hannah Gadsby. One of the biggest news stories of the year outside of Hollywood was immigration. And several musicians released songs addressing the crisis of refugees continuing to come to the United States and how our government is responding. Back in July, we featured three artists and their immigration-related songs, and you'll hear them throughout this special. Gabby Moreno came to the United States from Guatemala in her late teens because she wanted to make American indie music. Now she combines traditional Latin music with pop sensibilities, and this year she teamed up with famed producer Van Dyke Parks for an updated version of David Rutter's 1998 song, The Immigrants, to support the efforts to reunite families at the border.
The immigrants are here to stay to help build America.
Coming up next, some of our favorite interviews from the film world.
The immigrants ain't going nowhere. They're here for America.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director.
Welcome back to the Frames Year-End Special. I'm John Horn. We're bringing you some of our favorite interviews from the year, covering television, movies, music, and the arts. 2018 was a banner year for documentaries, and there were even a couple that were big hits at the box office, including RBG, about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And then there was Won't You Be My Neighbor, director Morgan Neville's film that traced the unlikely route that Fred Rogers followed for his PBS kid show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. As one of the show's producers puts it in the film, if you take all the elements that make good television and do the exact opposite, you have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, low production value, simple set, unlikely star, yet it worked. So how did Fred Rogers make it work? Well, here's what Morgan Neville told me.
I think it was because of him, you know, because of the trueness of his message and the way he was able to communicate with kids, that everything else was really secondary. And he created this really unique vision that was not only ahead of its time and apart from its time, but is unique in history. I mean, people are still not doing the things he was doing on his show.
Was part of the motivation for making the film kind of this exploration into the separation and overlap between the man and the character, and about who he was in private and who he was on television and how much of one mirrored the other? And was this guy for real, basically?
Well, I mean, that is the essential question. And there's actually this great book that he put out, a collection of letters he got and his responses to them. And it's one of my favorite things. He got more letters at one point than anybody in America, and he personally responded to every single letter. But the first letter in this book starts with, "Are you for real? Please tell me if you are for real, Mr. Rogers." And I think that's kind of essentially the question we all have. Like, is this guy for real? Like, can he really be this character? You know, what is the difference between the man and the character? And we're so used now to seeing this huge divide between our TV heroes and the people who play them. So I'm here to report that he's the same person, you know, but not exactly the same. And in many ways, Fred Rogers, as opposed to Mr. Rogers, was this deep thinker. He was a Presbyterian minister. He had a graduate degree in childhood development. He was a seeker. He wanted to learn his whole life, and he wanted to minister to people. He spoke many languages. He was a pacifist vegetarian. I mean, there are many intriguing things about him. And so in many ways, I think that Fred Rogers is actually a better character than Mr. Rogers, because he's a more dimensional version of what you would want Mr. Rogers to be.
And he also recognized, I think, before a lot of people did, that there was something really noxious about what children were seeing on television, and that he recognized that there needed to be some sort of corrective alternative, that he was motivated not just, you know, to put on a show, but to put on a show that wasn't even close to anything that was being produced or broadcast.
Yeah, I mean, he had this moment of kind of staggering insight when he came home from a college break, and this would have been 1949. His parents had gotten a television, and not many people had them at that point, and he had never seen it before. And on spring break, he was watching it and watching these shows where people were throwing pies in each other's faces and laughing, and he knew in that moment that this new device was going to change our society, and that there would be generations of children raised by this new box. and that somebody had to look out for them. And in that moment, he told his parents he was going to change his major. He was going to basically take a new life course. And instead of becoming a minister immediately, he decided to move to New York and used his family's connections to get a job at NBC and worked at Rockefeller Center for several years to learn the ins and outs of television. And I think there's something about the timing of it that if Fred Rogers had been born, I think even 5 years sooner or later, the show never would have happened. It was the perfect synchronicity of, you know, the right man with the right medium at the right time.
That was Morgan Neville, director of the documentary about Fred Rogers, Won't You Be My Neighbor? The film is now on the shortlist for the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. Now we'll turn to actress Tessa Thompson. Thompson was in the thriller Annihilation that also starred Natalie Portman. She was in the HBO series Westworld and in the Netflix series Dear White People. She also co-starred in Boots Riley's outlandish movie, Sorry to Bother You, in which she plays a performance artist who is dating the character played by co-star Lakeith Stanfield. I reached Thompson when she was on a break from shooting Creed II in Philadelphia, and she told me how Boots Riley pitched her on Sorry to Bother You.
He had a lot of big ideas that he wanted to talk about, and with this backdrop of telemarketing in a reality that's just a skosh away from our own and set in Oakland. And it's a project that he's, you know, has been in his heart and in his mind for a long time. He made a record by the same title, Sorry to Bother You, to entice people to make the film. And it's been a labor of love for him. And it's like just a little weird, pretty baby that I was like so excited to be a part of.
Hey, young blood, let me give you a tip. Use your white voice.
Man, I ain't got no white voice.
Oh, come on, you know what I mean. You have a white voice in there, you can use it. It's like when you're pulled over by the police.
Oh, no, I just use my regular voice when that happens. I just say, back the fuck up off the car and don't nobody get hurt.
All right, man, I'm just trying to give you some game.
I think it's a great conceit. For people who haven't seen the film, there is a sales pitch voice that a lot of people in this telemarketing firm adopt, and it's a white voice where people who in the film are African-American sound like they're incredibly Caucasian.
Hey, Mr. Kramer, this is Langston from Regal View. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
That was kind of a central conceit of the movie, isn't it?
It is, and I think what's so delicious about when you see my character, who's called Detroit, affect a white voice is that it's not in the space of telemarketing. It's actually when she's doing a performance art piece. She's an artist.
We will have a transformative experience.
And so there's this idea that, yes, as Black Americans, we feel like sometimes we have to code switch, particularly if we're trying to occupy a space of power. It's like what Donald Glover talks about getting his show made at FX. You have to learn how to speak old white man. And so, you know, as Black artists, we also do that. And I think, you know, Detroit is a character that can be very righteous and have sort of feel like she has a moral high ground in terms of Cassius using this white voice. But then she turns around and does it in her art. So the idea is that we don't just as Black Americans do that, but just as humans, sometimes we try to, you know, get in where we fit in and we affect a version of ourselves that we think is going to get us what we want.
I want to follow up on that. Do you think there is code switching in Hollywood, especially for people of color and women?
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like I've done my fair share of it without even knowing that I was, certainly.
What would you say it is? How does it reveal itself?
I guess, you know, for example, when you work inside of productions that are inherently misogynistic, or when you happen to be a woman on set and there are very few of you, and so you're in a position of being otherized just by the virtue or vice of being one of the only women on set, you're like the girl, you know? That was the remarkable thing in working on Alex Garland's Annihilation and worked with a primarily all-female cast, is you realize the ways in which you've been positioned on other productions. And sometimes it means that you're not allowed to, or you don't allow yourself to take up space in the same way.
That was actress Tessa Thompson. In 2019, you'll see her in a Men in Black reboot. Actor Riz Ahmed also had a busy and varied year. He was in the indie western The Sisters Brothers, which takes place during the Gold Rush, and he was also in the Marvel movie Venom as a sort of Elon Musk figure opposite Tom Hardy. He's also a rapper who records under the name Riz MC. When I caught up with Riz Ahmed back in September, we talked about what draws him to these diverse parts, and he revealed a change in how he's approaching his work, using more of himself in the process.
You know, there are many actors who approach their work in this way. You know, they're very kind of, they set out to kind of work through issues that they might have or things that are going on in their own life through the kind of vessel of this character. I've never approached my work like that at all. And it's something that's quite new to me in my process. It's something I'm starting to do now, which is to actively allow myself to put myself in my work. And it's apparently that's quite unusual. You know, it's quite unusual to kind of adamantly set out to keep your own life separate from the characters that you're playing. And there's also something potentially quite deluded about the idea that you could do that. But I've been kind of, happily kind of, you know, pursuing this delusion for a while now, but it's fast evaporating before my eyes. And now I'm kind of reveling in the kind of liberation that comes with, you know, allowing yourself into your work. Actually, I think the first time I ever actively and consciously allowed myself to draw upon my own life in my work was during the filming of Sisters Brothers.
What changed? Why did you feel that that was a thing that was the right thing to do at that point?
I haven't had a proper kind of training as an actor. I mean, I've did 1 year of Shakespeare after university. So I did that, and that was very much about kind of, you know, the text and how to, you know, use the verse form as something that's expressive rather than something that's constricting. And so a lot of kind of what I do is kind of stuff that I'm making up as I go along, and I kind of, you know, make lots of notes and try and kind of figure things out, and it's trial and error. And, you know, I actually read an interview with Vincent Cassel once, which I thought was interesting. He was talking about, as a younger actor, you're always trying to escape yourself. And then when you get to a certain age, you realize that you can't escape yourself. And actually, the scariest place to go and perhaps the most rewarding place to go is inside. And I think maybe it just might be that. It's kind of getting to a certain age where you realize that actually the scariest kind of frontier is the one within, and everything else is really kind of an act of escapism. I think it's also something to do with how I started acting and why I started acting. I think I grew up as someone who's code switching a lot, who grew up in a kind of working class Pakistani family, got a scholarship to a very white private school, and would skip off classes there to hang out with my rude boy mates, you know, in Northwest London on some street corner. And you know, I'd be quite literally changing the way I spoke and changing my clothes and my costume like 3 times a day, because this was my, you know, trajectory over the course of a day. And that's really about wearing masks. You know, it wasn't something that I was consciously doing, but it was about constructing masks and wearing masks. And that's a tricky thing to do. Not everyone can do it. And it's something that I can do well. So I've been doing that. And I think you get to a certain point where you realize, actually, that's limiting. Actually, you know, it's about taking off all these masks and going in naked. But in order to do that, in order to have the confidence to do that, you need to believe on some fundamental level that the micro specificity of your experience can be universally relatable. And I guess if you grow up in a kind of marginalized community, you kind of implicitly receive this message that it's not. You know, your experience is a bit weird and niche. So the way to get people to relate to you is by wearing masks. And I think I've just started to realize that, you know, I want to put these masks down. So it's a very new thing for me.
That was actor and rapper Riz Ahmed. There's no release date yet, but Ahmed is working on a modern day adaptation of Hamlet for Netflix.
Packed my bags and took the blame, put my house in my daughter's name.
Now another one of those artists who wrote and recorded immigration-related songs this year. Singer-songwriter Bea Beeman is the child of immigrant parents who came here from Sri Lanka. Now based in Los Angeles, Beeman this year released a new song and accompanying video called Beyond the Border, which tells of the horrors that many immigrants face coming to the United States.
It's like we're an outbreak.
You're listening to The Frame's 2018 Year in Review. Coming up next, some of our favorite interviews from the world of theater. Welcome back to The Frame's year-end special. I'm John Horn. We're bringing you some of our favorite interviews from the past year, covering television, movies, music, and the arts. Playwright David Henry Wong won a Tony Award in 1988 for his play M. Butterfly. Composer Janine Tesori won a Tony in 2015 for writing the music for Fun Home. They are two of the most respected and sought-after theater artists working today, and this year they collaborated on a new show called Soft Power. Wong was originally commissioned to write a play for the Mark Taper Forum's 50th anniversary, but along the way, he realized it should be a musical, and so he recruited Tesori. An art mirrored life in the show itself, which starts out as a comedic two-character play and then morphs into a full-blown musical that imagines China as the leading world power after the 2016 presidential election.
The original concept was that we were going to do sort of a flip on The King and I. So we were going to create this musical about a Chinese executive who comes to America and helps President Hillary Clinton solve the problem of gun violence. So we had a reading of an early draft the day of the election. And the next morning, I remember thinking, well, I think this is really bad for the country, but it could be really good for our musical.
And Janine, how does that change your job?
It didn't really change it. It made the stakes higher. There is power. There is soft power inside moving people to reveal stories that they may have not been thinking about. And at the end of this musical, it's ultimately about the desire to come together. There is, I think, a moral imperative of hope.
And even as you're making and telling a story about gun violence and about the failures of democracy, you're also trying to have a good time. And there's a song about the electoral college process, which is very funny and very entertaining and very topical, given that the president of the United States did not win the popular vote. How does that song make sense for this show? Because it feels really important to the story that you're telling.
Oh, good. Because
Don't tell me you're cutting it.
No, we're not. But I had brought up at one point, do we really need that Electoral College song? So, and we are keeping it. So yeah. This is sort of the collaboration of it.
I remember reading back in the day about the Louisiana Purchase and Napoleon saying, it's too large to govern, good luck, as he sold it, and thinking how unwieldy this country must seem at certain points. And certainly the Electoral College and certain policies in this country are Byzantine and people do not understand them.
The Electoral College ensured that smaller and rural states had a disproportional say in selecting a president, which in the early days of our great nation ensured they could keep their slaves.
You have Hillary Clinton as a very prominent figure in the story, and yet not by name is the person who she lost to mentioned. So why did you decide to do that? And then were there limits on what you thought Hillary Clinton could and could not do in the show? Because you don't seem to have too many limits on what she says and does.
If you look at The King and I, which was sort of a model for this, you never really hear the king's name. So similarly, in our show, the president is referred to, the vice president is referred to, and we don't hear their names. But Hillary Clinton is a character, and we certainly didn't put any restrictions on ourselves. I think that we, like any character, wanted to create a kind of sympathetic, complicated person who is in a fictional narrative, because in the Chinese musical within the show, she is having a glancing sort of romance with this Chinese executive. So we're putting a real-life character in a fictional situation and trying to do it with as much sensitivity as we can.
As much sensitivity as Hillary Clinton twerking can have, right?
Well, it's also a fever dream at the end of the day. And dreams, I know that somehow they resemble reality and they don't at all. Hillary is, yes, she twerks. She twerks because we make women do 10 times as much for a tenth of the goods in the end. And would we ever really let a woman be president, I think, is the real question. What does one have to do?
That was playwright David Henry Wong and composer Janine Tesori. They collaborated on the musical Soft Power. Wong has said he hopes the show will make it to Broadway. And now, Sarah Jones is a playwright, performer, and activist. And this year, she assembled all her passions and talents into the show Sell by Date, which was produced at the Geffen Playhouse. While the play is technically a one-woman show, Jones performs a variety of characters in the piece, and all of them are connected by a common theme, the sex industry.
What do I think of prostitution? Are you soliciting me, young man? First of all, stripping, but then like all the other things you're talking about, prostitution and all that stuff, it's like not the same thing at all.
That is the unique part of it for me, right, is that I ended up first in the convent and then in the prostitution after. That's right.
Sell by Date is built around a series of recorded interviews replayed decades later in a classroom of the future. When I spoke with Jones, she explained her thinking behind the title.
It's called Sell by Date, which I use as a jumping off point, right? If you know, a sell by date is the expiration date on something. And the idea is we're looking at empowerment, women, sex, and culture, especially in this Me Too moment. And how sustainable is where we are right now? Let's ask lots of people from lots of different backgrounds.
I want to ask you about the experiences that informed the story for you. There are so many different things that you did as part of your research, teaching poetry to girls on Rikers Island, visiting a house of, or window, I guess, of prostitution in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. How did you take all of those experiences and interviews and coalesce a story around it?
You know, in some ways it was, I've been doing research for a lifetime. And teaching poetry on Rikers, I actually did that years ago, but I met so many girls. These are young girls who are high school age, right? In theory, you shouldn't be on Rikers Island, right? But there were so many examples of girls who had just ended up in these situations because of coercion or exploitation by somebody else. And so really, I've been doing the research forever. I've been, you know, a young woman who, when I was a kid, I saw Pretty Woman, and that was a little confusing because I loved Julia Roberts and I loved that story, but sort of it didn't jibe. You know, I kind of went, well, she's a hooker with a heart of gold. I don't know how much I'm buying. So I was curious. I really did research almost for my own purposes and then tried to create a show that would speak to everybody, anybody and everybody, as long as you're over about 14 or 15. It's PG-14, I'd say.
When you think you know something about a subject and then you actually get in the field and start researching the subject more intimately and personally, what surprised you about your preconceptions?
Yeah, I mean, I think I should almost let a few of the characters speak to this because they...
I am here to listen.
Well, I really try to take myself and the audience on a journey, and you meet, let's see, I'll see if she'll come out and talk to us.
You're putting on your glasses, your nanny glasses.
So, hi there, my name is Lorraine Levine, and I'm here because Sarah puts me in her shows, what she calls her one-woman shows. And you know what that means, of course. I mean, she takes the credit and makes us come out and do all the work. But I talk about my experience as a woman of a certain age around, you know, sex and intimacy. You don't hear about it all the time with older people.
And then, you know, we meet other characters. Like, my name is Nereida. I'm in the show talking about how, yeah, as somebody who's of Dominican descent, I should say that I'm half Dominican, half Puerto Rican, all proud. But, you know, like, there's a lot of women on this planet who their only choice really is to use what they were born with, you know, and to have your body be your own economy. What does that look like? So I try to bring as many different voices. This is Sarah again. You know, I have these characters in sort of my repertoire from years of growing up in diverse communities and hearing all these different voices around me that sound like music and like what America is made of.
And now another one of the artists who wrote and recorded immigration-related songs this year. Texas-based songwriter Radney Foster grew up in Del Rio near the Mexican border, and years ago, when his ex-wife took their son to live in France, he wrote Godspeed, Sweet Dreams about the pain of that separation. This year, he translated the song into Spanish in solidarity with families at the border and to send a message to his conservative fan base.
Dios bendiga a mami muñequitas.
Dios bendiga, papi, y las estrellitas.
Coming up, we wrap up our 2018 review with an icon of LA's visual art scene and with songs about the state of America after the 2016 presidential election. Bendiciones, mis hijos. Welcome back to the Frames year-end special. I'm John Horn. We're bringing you some of our favorite interviews from the past year. One afternoon in September, we got out of the studio and headed over to a nondescript building in Culver City, the kind of plain industrial-type place that maybe could house a tech startup or an insurance company. But inside, it's actually the studio of one of LA's most respected and influential artists, Ed Ruscha. He first moved to Los Angeles in the 1950s for art school, and over the decades, Ruscha has integrated elements of the city's landscape, like the Hollywood sign and Norm's Diner, into his work. Words, letters, and typography fascinate Ruscha, and they're often prominent in his paintings. We talked about that while wandering around his studio, where pieces sat in various states of completion. I asked Ruscha if what motivates him now is any different from what motivated him back when he started out.
I think I kind of look at it as though I take my lunch pail to work. And, you know, it's I like the studio work and just being here and being around all these little things that I've brought into these rooms. And that's a good part of the whole issue.
Would you say that your creative process has changed materially from when you would first say you were doing the kind of work that you're probably best known for?
Well, the way I approach things is usually it's like an involuntary reflex, and something will come to me, and I've got to make it official, so I end up making a widget out of it, some kind of artwork. And it usually involves words or something that someone said or I heard on the radio, maybe your program, I don't know. But it begins somewhere like that.
Can I ask you about these pieces over here?
Yeah. Now, these are drum skins previously used, you can see. And so they're vellum. They're animal skins.
One says, I done did that. The other one says, nobody denied nothing. And the other one says, I won't never.
And I got on to painting these a few years ago, and somehow the concept of double negatives came into my life because I grew up with people that spoke this way. I done did that. And I never done it. Things like that. And so these works kind of revolve around that.
Is that something that's always been common in your work? Do you think back more now toward people you've encountered over your life that had memorable things to say?
Yeah, I grew up in Oklahoma, and there's a particular angle to their dialect there that they have, and I was very acutely aware of it and amused by it. And so how it leaked into my... It seems like you would run from something like that. I mean, this is incorrect English, you know. You would run from that, but no, I embraced it. I mean, I like seeing it and exposing it.
I want to ask you about this piece that is now at the Broad. And there are people I know who would look at the long lines of people outside the Broad any day, any hour. There's a lot of people lined up outside the museum, and I remember pointing out to somebody, and they said, well, they're just here to take selfies with the art. And my response was, I don't know that that's a bad thing.
No.
Does it matter to you what people do once they're in a museum?
No. And, you know, children are there, people for any number of reasons. They go there to just see what's happening or maybe to cool off from the hot weather. It doesn't matter. But getting the turnstile to work and have people coming into the museum is an essential part of the whole thing.
That was visual artist Ed Ruscha. If your goal is to cross the United States in a hurry, Amtrak is not the ideal option. The trip takes about 4 days if you're lucky. But if you've got the time and are eager to meet strangers from all walks of life, Riding the Rails is a perfect choice, which back in November 2016 is exactly what Brooklyn-based composer Gabriel Kahane aimed to do. Just after the presidential election, he left his cell phone in the daily news cycle behind and jumped on a train. 13 days, 31 states, and dozens of dining car meals later, Kahane returned to New York with a full diary and the inspiration to write a song cycle of character sketches and personal reflections. The completed piece is called 8980, Book of Travelers. When Gabriel Kahane came to the studio, I asked him about the people that he met on his trip.
It was an interesting mix. There, I certainly encountered some people of extreme privilege, and I also encountered people, you know, religious Luddites from Ohio. I encountered all kinds.
I want to play one of the songs from Book of Travelers. This song is called November.
And I want to tell you about November, the people that I met. And sleeping badly on Pullman pallets, a blue blanket caked in sweat.
How would you describe the mood that you were in when you're writing a song like that? And is it similar to the mood you were in while you're sleeping or trying to sleep on the train?
I think I wrote that song in April of this year. And it kind of signaled a turning point in the project where I started to understand the frame of it. I guess I had enough distance from the trip and enough distance from the initial shock of being in this new political paradigm. You know, Wordsworth has this thing. He says, poetry is the act of, and I'm paraphrasing really badly, recalling tempestuous emotion in tranquility. I had kept a pretty detailed diary along the trip, so I had a lot of notes about all the people that I met, but there was a certain degree of trying to put myself back in that space in order to write these songs.
There are ways that Amtrak operates in terms of meal service that you, if you're traveling by yourself, you're kind of assigned to random tables. It's almost like kind of anthropological speed dating. You're just thrown in with somebody and you hear his or her life story if they want to share it and if you're interested in hearing it.
I think that's a beautiful way of describing it, anthropological speed dating. You know, as a solo passenger, I was always the third or fourth wheel, sometimes to a couple, sometimes to three single people. And it was extraordinary how forthcoming people were. And I think one of the great revelations of the trip was kind of having to interrogate my own sense of what diversity means as a progressive and realizing that, you know, as a white dude from Brooklyn, it was much easier for me to go up to a person of color on the train than it was for someone who I read as being rural, white, potential Trump voter. And I found that as much of a sort of hallmark cliche as it seems, we do have more in common than we're led to believe. And that ideological difference is something that's leveraged by people in power to consolidate power. And I feel like if we were able to look at system more than symptom, the systems that are in place that lead to people being vulnerable to racial animus, and we're able to look at the folks on high who are leveraging that difference to prevent solidarity, we might be in a slightly better place. And that, I guess, so in a sense, this piece, it's very non-ideological. It's a lot of people telling stories about family.
That was singer and composer Gabriel Kahane. His album, 8980, Book of Travelers, was released this year, and you're hearing Model Trains, one of my favorite songs from the collection. And that will do it for the Frame's 2018 year in review. Thanks so much for listening. Here's to a great 2019.
I would please him every day, the pattern of